This is the fourth in our series of studies on a collision of kingdoms as we look at these chapters of Matthew, following hard on the heels of the Sermon on the Mount. Now, some of the principles we learned there being translated into action as we see Jesus Christ at work. So what have we got here? Matthew 9, well, we've got the ruler who comes to kneel before Jesus. We've got the lady who is suffering from a hemorrhage who came to him. We've got the two blind men who came running after Christ. We've got the dumb demoniac. It was once commented that when things are going well and youth is on your side, well, we tend to treat life as if it was a circus. We imagine that we're master of ceremonies in life's circus ring. We enter the ring with our buckskin breeches on and a silk hat, cracking a whip, and we think that we can make everything work to our order. But then sooner or later, a lion may break out of its cage there in the circus and come snarling up to us. That is the day when life's realities catch up with us in our own personal crisis, and our view of life as one great circus moving to our every command has to be revised. Here is Jesus in Matthew 9 as the great helper in four case studies involving people whose own personal crisis brought them to him, all on the same day, and in fact probably within the same hour. It was the moment for each of them when the structures of life as they knew it collapsed around them, when the lion was out of its cage and staring them in the face. There's the ruler of the synagogue, here in verse 18. If he's got it there, have you got the Bible open? Don't look at me, look at the Bible. Verse 18, we know his name is Jairus from the parallel accounts in Mark 5 and Luke 8. The ruler of the synagogue, overwhelmed at the prospect of losing his only daughter at the age of 12. There's the woman of verse 20, driven to the limit of her endurance by her severe and embarrassing bleeding complaint. There were the two blind men of verse 27, shouting aloud in their desperate attempt to halt Jesus in his tracks. And then there is the dumb man of verse 32, who was in such a crisis that others had to bring him in his extremity. So the question poses itself, and it's a question that is relevant to absolutely every single one of us in church this morning. Can anyone come to Jesus? It's a very simple question. Can anyone come? Let's make that our first question as we meditate on the passage. Theoretically, we are probably in agreement as to what the answer is to that question. Yes, we say, of course. Anyone can come. But then I think of a woman who used to live in Essex some years ago. I used to know her. She once said to me, I just hadn't the cheek to approach Jesus Christ when for so many years I hadn't given him a thought. Four cameos are introduced to us here of people who had had no relationship with Jesus at all. None of them could have been described as particularly deserving cases, perhaps. In fact, the woman with the hemorrhage complaint oughtn't to have been in the crowd at all. Ritually, she was impure, according to the dictates of Leviticus 15 and verse 25. If the rabbis had had their way, she would have been confined at home. But in these passages, what we are confronted with is a collision of kingdoms. As the actions and the ministry of Jesus, following on the heels of the earlier teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, ushered in the values of the kingdom of God, fulfilling the old order, true, but also superseding it. So it didn't matter if you were on the periphery of society, didn't matter if you had contravened the taboos, didn't matter even if you were a non-Jew, anyone can come. And how did they come? Well, these sentences from verse 18 to 34 give us in highly concentrated form Matthew's vivid account of someone first of all coming urgently. Do you see it there? Well, that, of course, was Jairus, the ruler from the synagogue there in Capernaum. You can still see some of the ruins of that first century synagogue today. So here is this prominent man. Normally, others would have come to him with their requests, the top man in the synagogue. Now it's his own personal crisis, and all other help has failed. And whether as good as dead, or in fact actually dead at that precise moment, it was really immaterial in regard to his precious and only, as Luke tells us, his only daughter. The bottom has fallen out of life for that ruler. And there he is, kneeling before Jesus. He had come urgently. The lady with the hemorrhage complaint, she came secretly. Yes, she was breaking the taboos in mixing with a crowd like that. She got actually pretty well everything wrong. It was an ill-timed moment because Jesus, as he was at that moment dealing with Jairus, was right in the middle of another case. But she couldn't wait her turn. And she hopes to get away with it by a surreptitious, even a superstitious, touch of Christ's clothes. She comes secretly. Others came desperately. Verse 27, here are two blind men struggling in the wake of Jesus and yelling at the top of their voices, "Have mercy on us, son of David." As one commentator points out, their theology could have been better did they only see Jesus and see in him a conquering hero from David's ancestry. But this was their one moment. And with all their inadequate understanding, they came desperately. And yet another comes helplessly. Verse 32, the dumb demoniac, some occult power had a hold upon this individual's power to speak. And such is his predicament that he comes with no motive at all. Actually, he has to be brought by others. They do it for him because he can't do it for himself. And come, he does. And that's the important point. However unready, however unprepared, however untaught a man or woman may be, however unfit we may be to come to Jesus Christ, the great thing is to come. Even if it's for a very poor and secondary reason. Tax collectors and sinners came, scribes and Pharisees, highway beggars, the wealthy, the poor, the city people and the country people, the learned and the uneducated, the rulers and the nonentities. And here are just four instances carved out and collected carefully for us by Matthew, coming urgently, secretly, desperately, helplessly, people face to face with their own crisis. Yes, everybody has a story who has come to Jesus. And all the stories are different. Don't know what your story is. Such a privilege to have been in Moscow last week for those 3 days with our orchestra and to meet with the residents of Moscow and to have music with them and then to speak to them as well. And I had a wonderful interpreter, Russian, of course, who spoke wonderful Russian, so I was told by those who knew. He was a great interpreter. And I said to him, while we were preparing and praying for our ministry together, I said to him, "Tell me, what is your story? How is it you come to be a believer?" Oh, he said, "It happened 5 years ago when I was an ardent atheist." In fact, he said, "I was a committed member of the Communist Youth League." And he said it was at school. I was a teacher at the school. And the headmaster said to me one day, "We've got trouble in the school. There's a girl in the form, one of those classes. She's only 7, but she's a troublemaker, a real troublemaker. She's a Christian. Not only is she a Christian, but she's worse, she's a Baptist." "And I want you to sort it out," said the headmaster, "and clean this up and stamp on it. Can't have any more of this." So the teacher went to see this girl of seven. And the girl of seven prized open all his defenses, started by asking, how convinced are you that there's no God? Go on, how convinced are you? One by one, his defenses were split open by this little squib of a small girl. She led him to the Lord. And there he was as an intellectual, being my interpreter, 5 years later. So Christ met him in his own personal crisis, was on him. Can anybody come? The answer is yes, no matter what convention and prejudice may tell you to the contrary, however unready we may feel ourselves to be. Anyone can come. Very simple answer, but let's remember it and hold to it. Secondly, will anything happen if we come? Again, what a simple question, but how vital. Will anything happen if I come to Jesus? In instance after instance in these passages of Matthew, it's quite apparent that here, in Jesus Christ, is no mere dispenser of good advice. Not for him the parroting of threadbare cliches or the somber nodding of the head and saying, I'm hearing you. There's nothing wrong in being a good listener, but Christ is more than that. Whatever the poor motive in coming to him, our Lord honors the coming of those who are in need and meets men and women at that point. I recall when we had one of those embassy receptions that from time to time we put on in our church, simply because we're surrounded by the embassies here. And we invited, therefore, ambassadors and first and second secretaries and attaches to come and meet with us. About 80 were there. The last occasion, Canon John Chapman of Australia was our speaker, our invited speaker, and there he was surrounded by Muslims and materialists and Buddhists and Confucianists. And I remember his words to these people, these leaders. He said, wherever I travel around our two hemispheres, I find that there are certain experiences and crisis points common to every class and culture. On every continent, he said, I meet with achievement, disappointment, success, anxiety, sorrow, and bereavement. And then John Chapman said, my own testimony and experience is that Jesus Christ has met me at every single one of those points. It's not, of course, that turning to Jesus is equivalent to turning to some genie-like figure who's at our beck and call. Prayer isn't the same as rubbing a little magic lamp and exerting our will upon circumstances and events. If it were, then it would be the old story of the ringmaster in command of the circus. We're not in command. And prayer is not a technique or a magical power. It's a relationship. And that's brought home to us again and again when Jesus meets with these four case studies. And we find how he enters into a relationship with each one individually. Every story is different. So when he gets finally to Jairus' house, and there's the little girl. Yes, they say she's dead. She's gone. Don't trouble the master anymore. And there are the professionals. They've moved in. The flute players. They were hired to come in and do the music. And Christ has to get them all out of the place so that he can truly minister. And then take her by the hand and say, little lamb. That's the word, really, in the Aramaic. Little lamb, I say to you, arise. And how he's able to calm Jairus when Jairus thinks, oh, it's too late. And how he's able to say to the lady with the hemorrhage, daughter, it's all right. With that in mind, we can see how the Lord, as he meets these different inquirers, helps them not according precisely to their own expectations necessarily, but according to what he, the King and Sovereign of all life, perceives that need to be. Why, here is the restorer,
of sight and of health, of hearing, of energy at work. He does it in his own time and manner. So here is Jairus, the ruler, aware of the urgency. Jesus, in verse 19, we read, arose and followed him. What wonderful words! Elsewhere in the Gospel stories, we read of those fishermen by the lake who leave their nets, arose and followed Jesus. Now here is Jesus arising and following somebody else just because he's asked him to come to his house. Jesus will do that. He came, as he said in Mark 10:45, not to be served, but to serve. That is why he came. We can't believe it at times. He came to serve you? Yes, he did. You say, I can't accept that. Surely I'm here to serve him. He came for you and for me. Let's allow that to sink into our consciousness today, because all of us have predicaments. And maybe somebody here is facing an impossible week ahead where you just dread it. Let us believe that Christ will meet you in this week that is ahead of you, strengthen you. Here he is, living it out now, this wonderful principle. He arose and followed Jairus. However, there's a delay on the road because of the incident with the afflicted woman. We can imagine Jairus hopping with impatience while this is going on. But the woman's need is given time and is met fully. And then the eventual arrival at the house, but disaster. It's too late. No, it's not too late. It is never too late with Jesus Christ. And the miracle takes place of the raising of the little girl. The same with the blind man that follows later. The same with the dumb demoniac. Will anything happen when people come to Jesus? Despite the obstacles that are there at every turn, the obstacles of the crowd, the apparent delay, poor motives, the intrusion of evil, you know, there's nearly always something to impede. It's never convenient to come to Christ. But in every one of these four instances, the answer is yes, something does happen when people come to Jesus. Sometimes his answer comes in an unexpected way. Sometimes his timing is quite different from what we would have chosen it to be. But something does happen when people come to Jesus. Sometimes we get tremendous surprises. I remember years ago in another church that I was leading, where a lady, and she's happy for me to say this, came to the church in desperation. It was a guest service. And the lay reader was preaching, and sitting there in the service, she invited Jesus Christ to come right into her life and to sort out her predicament. Then she sat talking with somebody else afterwards about it, explained what the predicament was. She'd taken a lover, and they'd been living together, and there was this lover back at home, and she didn't know how to get rid of the situation. She knew that it must end, but how was it to end without an appalling, terrible scene? It was prayed about, then she went home. Then I got a phone call after lunch, almost hysterical, from the lady. Come quickly, come right away to my house. I thought something awful had happened. Quite the reverse. Something amazing had happened. When I got there, she explained to me with brimming eyes what had happened. That while she'd been in the service earlier that morning, the lover had upped and gone and taken with him every single possession he owned, every single reminder of himself that he'd ever existed, and she never saw him again. In that extraordinary moment, the whole thing was solved. Maybe it doesn't always happen like that, but every now and then there are these reminders. Christ does meet us in our predicaments. Can anyone come? Yes. Will anything happen? Well, again we must say yes in answer to that question. And then my third and last question. Has anything changed today? By that I mean, nearly 2,000 years later, should our expectations be any different from those of that first century AD when people came to Jesus, the bottom having dropped out of their life, and he met them in their need? The answer is, I think, everything has changed dramatically. Here in Matthew, we're reading of a collision of kingdoms taking place, the establishing of a bridgehead into the territory of ignorance, fear, superstition, and entrenched evil and interests that were marshaled against the interests of other people. So what Jesus was doing was going to rattle many of the established interests of that time. The hierarchy were dismayed and rattled by it all. We see that at the very end of our reading, when after these four wonderful episodes, the Pharisees said, "He casts out demons by the prince of demons." And so they ascribe the mighty works of Jesus to evil and turn the whole thing on its head, which is what people actually today will do at times as well. Say, "Oh, no, he's a deceiver." These miracles, the stilling of the storm, the healing of leprosy sufferers and the blind, the healing of paralytics, yes, and the raising of the dead, are the tokens of the new heaven and the new earth, the reordered and recast universe, which is yet to be, but which we are assured is certainly coming, when the rule of God will be exerted universally over all that has up to now been chaotic by reason of the fall. It's not that the eyes of the blind would be opened miraculously on all fronts in coming centuries, any more than that the dead would be raised with ever-increasing frequency. Even here in the Gospel stories, after all, there's a kind of selection about these miracles. You must have noticed that. Why did Jesus heal only one of those who were paralyzed at the pool of Bethesda in John chapter 5? There were many who were sick there. Well, it's because these wonderful actions of the Lord were selected indications of the ultimate rule of God in the coming kingdom. And the hints are here of what that was to mean in the future, of the complete difference with which we would be able to look at our universe and our situation in coming generations. The hints are here. So verse 25, when Jesus says within the household, the little girl, she's not dead, she's sleeping. They can't accept it. They start to laugh even. And I think to myself, yes, Christ gives to the worst of our enemies, death, the pleasantest of names, sleep. That's the difference that Jesus makes. And of course, we were to see that as the gospel advanced in the future, and we were to see the expansion of the church. And then in every country today, there are people who look differently at the whole subject of death and the enemies that face us. And these episodes here, why, they form the curtain raiser, so that, for example, the raising of Jairus' daughter pointed ahead to the great miracle, the victory of the Son of Man himself over death and the grave, never to die again, with the offer of eternal life and a share in his victory universally to all who believe upon him. It is different today. Jairus' daughter would die again one day. There were a number of them there, weren't there, in Palestine, whom people would point to as the years went by and they got older and older. See that old lady there? That old lady with the grey hair and the walking stick? That's Jairus' daughter. Oh yes, years ago, you know, she was raised from the dead. Of course, before long, she'd be in her grave. Or Lazarus and a few of those other extraordinary Jesus generation, they would be in their graves. They would die twice. But these wonderful incidents were pointers to a new and coming generation, of which I trust you are part this morning. A new generation that would number millions of people in every country, people who don't fear the grave because of Christ's coming and victory, and who, like him, will receive in glory resurrection bodies, never to die again. That is the greater miracle that puts these other miracles in the shade. It's that colors all our thinking about infirmity and about death today that puts the gospel perspective onto the sudden and unexpected taking of George Hoffman from us, referred to earlier in our service. It's these incidents that act as a spur to so many who, like George Hoffman, have invested their lives, their energies, in extending Christ's care to the dispossessed and the oppressed of our world today. And even on our very local level, I mean the tea run mentioned in our notice sheet this morning, which you must have noticed their coming meeting that they're going to have, the numbers of people here are involved in. We'll be meeting to plan afresh for later this month. Why? It's a further ripple in the ministry of Christ himself. So has anything changed since Christ's day? Yes, certainly it has. Calvary and Easter have taken place, and Pentecost, with its gift of the Spirit to all believers everywhere. So the whole dimension is greater in which we work and witness today, altogether greater. It's expanded from the local to the universal. It's expanded from the temporal to the eternal. The Lord met with people in those early days, met them on a very practical but temporary level, nevertheless. Today, it's wider, deeper, more ultimate than it could ever be then. One of my nicest examples, I think, is taken from a wonderful doctor of recent years, Hugh Orr Ewing. I expect some of us will remember him. He was from Bristol. I remember him very well, family friend. He was a terrifying man to drive with because he only had one eye that could see anything at all. And as he drove, he would be looking over his shoulder, cracking joke after joke, telling stories. I never heard him tell the same story twice. He lived and he prayed and he worshipped and he drove with gusto. And then one spring, 1987, he died in Bristol. And he died as he drove, with buoyancy. At the funeral, a tape was played, which he'd recorded earlier. And the people who came to the funeral heard Hugh Orr Ewing's voice, aged nearly 96, saying, "I really must thank you all today for coming to my funeral. But you're all here because you think I'm dead. I'm sorry to have to disappoint you, but I am more than ever alive at this moment." It's good to smile. You see, we can do that. We sometimes smile through tears because of the undercurrent of joy when somebody close is called on to the next life in whatever circumstance it may be and however tragic it may seem. Christ is in charge. He meets us at these crisis points. He can be trusted. The trustworthiness of Christ, that's what we're thinking about. We learn from our account today. Can anyone come? Yes. Will anything happen? Yes. Has anything changed today? Yes, the whole universe is different in the way we look at it because of this King who can be trusted to meet us when life moves from being a circus into a crisis.